This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. It wasn't exactly a typical 4th of July weekend in Boston this year. Now, of course, there were sounds we had been longing to hear, like the return of the Boston Pops to the Esplanade after a 3-year hiatus. But music and fireworks weren't the only sounds echoing through the streets over the weekend.
They rip children from wombs and sell a ground beneath your feet to foreigners. And then they tell you it is justice.
Nazis out of Boston! 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 Nazis out of Boston!
On Saturday, dozens of people with faces hidden, carrying the flags and banners of Patriot Front, a white supremacist group, marched along the Freedom Trail. The group also allegedly attacked a local black artist, Charles Morrell. Morrell and community leaders returned to the spot of the alleged attack on Monday.
Another man done gone from the county farm. Another man done gone.
WBUR's Walter Wuthman has been covering the fallout of Saturday's march, including a press conference yesterday held by Boston Mayor Michelle Wu. She was joined by U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, FBI Special Agent in Charge Joseph R. Bonavolonta, and Boston Acting Police Commissioner Gregory Long. Walt joins us now with the latest. Welcome back, Walt.
Hey, Tiziana.
Okay, so there's a lot to unpack, but I want to start with the press conference yesterday. What did Mayor Wu have to say?
Yes, this was a media briefing. It was called by Mayor Wu and U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, obviously after Saturday's march. And the big headline was that law enforcement seemed to be caught off guard, unaware, and frankly surprised by this, you know, march of 100 people going through Boston on Saturday, this white supremacist group, Patriot Front. They were surprised. They talked about that a little bit. And then the other main thing is that they say they have video recordings of this alleged assault on Charles Morrell. They have multiple detectives assigned to the case. They are trying to identify the alleged assailants who were wearing face coverings. And they seem to think that they have pretty good leads. Here's Mayor Michelle Wu. She said the city and the police are committed to both identifying the people who attacked Charles Morrell and bringing charges.
The individuals who were involved with the assault of Mr. Morrell need to be prosecuted within the fullest extent of the law.
Okay, so let's talk about this question about whether the group had a permit, Walt, how they coordinated this demonstration. Did we find out any more about what the city knew before the group marched on Saturday? You mentioned surprise. Let's tackle those questions.
They did not have a permit, which is actually not uncommon in Boston. There have been plenty of large demonstrations, you know, after the abortion decision came down, Black Lives Matter demonstrations, Ukraine solidarity rallies. Many of those marches do not have permits. So that's not unusual. And that was part of the reason police were surprised. You know, they had no advance warning. It really seems that this group, Patriot Front, which represents members in multiple states, and it also seems people from multiple states traveled to Boston for this march. They planned it in secret in some form.
So that might imply, and we'll touch on this more later, that the police weren't tracking them in the way to have seen something like this coming, correct?
Yes. They were asked many questions to that effect at the media briefing yesterday, and they're a bit, they say there's a lot of information they cannot, you know, say publicly at this point, but they were not monitoring the group as a specific threat to come to Boston and to, you know, this event that ended in violence.
Okay, so speaking of monitoring hate groups, which is sometimes something that the FBI does, yesterday they were at the presser. I know we heard from them. Tell us a little more about what they had to say.
So they had to answer multiple questions about this. How could you be caught off guard? Philip Martin, a great reporter at GBH who tracks these groups, you know, said there's all of this information online. There's videos. How is it that people in the media seem to have a better idea, better ideas about this group than you do? And U.S. Attorney Rollins pushed back on that again, saying there's things you can't say publicly. But, you know, the First Amendment protects a lot of speech, even speech that some people might consider vile or hateful. And FBI Special Agent in Charge Joseph Bonavolonta was essentially explaining that unless there is a specific credible threat, they can't just surveil and start investigations. Here's a little bit of what he said.
hate speech can be at times covered by the First Amendment. If it rises to a level where there is a threat or use of force or violence, that is where we can and have gotten involved and initiated investigations.
So he says there was no specific threat or tip known in advance, so they could not act preemptively to stop this march.
And just briefly, Walt, what do we know about next steps from here?
The main next steps seem to be identifying these alleged assailants from the video recordings and possibly bringing criminal charges.
Okay, so Walt, I know you're going to stay with us. Stand by. I want to bring another voice in here. On the line, interim Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden. He is currently running for the office and was at yesterday's press conference held by the city. DA Hayden, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Oh, thank you. Good to hear from you again. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. And I want to ask you, we're going to dive into some of the legal questions, but I want to start, where were you when you found out about the march and what did you find yourself thinking?
Yeah, so I was actually on the Cape at the time. I got a call immediately from the commissioner as to what was going on. And he debriefed me on the circumstances and I headed back to Boston.
And at that time, did you have a sense that there was something illegal going on? There are questions about, you know, freedom of speech versus the presence of marchers whose message is removing the rights of other people or being violent or threatening to other people. How then were you thinking about that tension? How are you thinking about it now?
Well, I think I'm thinking about it the same way everyone else is. My understanding from the very beginning was that there was an African-American man that was assaulted in a confrontation with that group. That is obviously something that would give rise to a crime, and that was our first concern. I know that there continues to be an active investigation into this matter, we intend, and as you heard Mayor Wu's comments earlier, and I stand in full agreement with that, that if we're able to identify and bring charges against the perpetrators here, we absolutely can and will do that, and we will prosecute them to the fullest extent of the law.
So DA Hayden, as I understand it, right now the investigation of the alleged assault on Charles Morrell stands then with the Boston Police Department, and your office does not come into play unless they can confirm it happened, identify the people who did it, and then bring them forward for you to charge. Is that correct?
That's correct. But we are in close concert with them. They reached out. The commissioner reached out to me right away. A member of their civil rights division at Boston Police Department reached out to our high risk victims unit right away, and we'll certainly assist in any way that we can. But our real involvement would not ensue until there's actually charges brought.
And could you put into context for us, please, DA Hayden, the involvement of the Civil Rights Division of the Boston Police Department? What is the civil rights dimension from a legal standpoint of what's going on here?
Sure. I mean, that's probably a question better asked of the Boston Police Department. But I think that, here where we have a confrontation, an assault that involved a known white supremacist group, one that was not welcome here, and that something ensued from that, that would be the logical place, I think, for the Boston Police Department to start with their investigation.
How tricky.
I just comment briefly on sort of yesterday's meeting interaction. I think there's two really important things that came out of that. One is a really promising and encouraging unified front from so many members of our Boston community who firmly stand against white supremacy and against groups like this, and also a very clear communication that we always want to make sure that when we are handling groups like this, whoever they may be, that we're doing so fairly and justly and uniformly across the board.
We're talking with interim Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden about the march by members of Patriot Front on Saturday in downtown Boston. DA Hayden, you talked about that unified front at the same time, and it was evident at the press conference yesterday. Walter Withman, who's still here with me in the studio, was talking about this, that there is tension about whether or not the city knew what it should have known and was prepared in the ways it should have been prepared. How do you address that?
Sure. I think we have to look forward and look to be unified and work collaboratively. It's very easy for us to play Monday morning quarterback in situations like this. This is a group that does operate covertly, secretively. They didn't announce they're coming here. And so I think that was part of the factors that played in here. But regardless of what happened, we as a community here in Boston need to stand firmly together and united. And I think we did that yesterday, despite tension and controversy, need to stand together against hate and against these white supremacist groups.
So
I know we can and will do that.
I hear and I respect what you're saying. I also can imagine... How do we ensure for our communities of color in Boston that in the future we don't have to Monday morning quarterback something again?
Sure. That's part of what was discussed in the meeting and talked about, making sure that we continue to collaborate and have action plans for these sorts of situations going forward.
Next steps for your office, DA Hayden?
Well, we'll continue to assist the Boston Police Department any way we can with this investigation. If charges are brought, then we'll have to deal with warrants and bringing the people that perpetrated this crime to justice. We'll continue to work collaboratively with the mayor, with the Boston Police, and with all of our community partners on these sensitive issues. I know they're important to everybody, and we always want to make sure that we're handling protests in a fair and equitable fashion whenever people are exercising their rights to free speech. And we also want to make sure that people's exercising of their rights to free speech does not go to another level, does not get out of hand. And that's something that we will collaborate with everybody on.
All right. Interim Suffolk County District Attorney Kevin Hayden, who's currently running for the office. I know you're very busy. Appreciate your time. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You take care.
You too. Briefly back over to Walter Withman from WBUR here in the station. Just reactions there, Walt.
I think it's interesting that the DA concretely says, you know, he believes Morrell was assaulted. There are images and there's Morrell's account. You know, it really appears he was assaulted by these members of the white supremacist group. But Patriot Front on their Telegram channels, they dispute that account. They say that it was Morrell who assaulted them. So it is interesting to hear Hayden definitively say, no, he was assaulted by this group. And then to the Monday morning quarterbacking point, I think this is a major concern for Mayor Wu. She wants to really make sure that, you know, even if they don't know in advance of a flash protest or a flash march, that doesn't mean they can't have plans of how to respond the next time.
When it does.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. So, Walt, stay with us. I'm going to turn now to former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling, served in the Trump administration, to help give us some better sense of the connection between what's happening locally and the national context for this. Andrew, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you joining us. I know you were listening to that conversation with DA Hayden, so let me just get your reactions there first.
Well, I think DA Hayden had it right. I mean, one of the first problems you have is that there is a First Amendment right to protest, even when it is disrupted in a lot of lately. But in a very distinct category is damage to property or hurting other people. And so the alleged assault should be aggressively investigated, and if it can be prosecuted, it should be prosecuted. But overall, these kinds of disruptions are going to happen, and you pointed to the national level. You're going to see it more and more on the national level, that you have groups on the fringes of both sides of the spectrum that are making themselves heard either through public marches, other public displays, or other disruptions of day-to-day life.
So we are speaking with former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling. Andrew, we've got a choppy line with you. I'm going to take a second, send you back. We're going to see if we can clean up your line a bit. I'll talk here with WBUR's Walter Withman for a minute, and we'll come back. When we do come back with Andrew Lelling, Walt, I want to talk more about efforts to identify people who were masked and may have participated in the alleged assault. I know there's a lot of qualifiers there in what I just said. What did we hear yesterday at the press conference more specifically about those efforts to identify masked people?
The police were very clear that they have videos, you know, and even though the commissioner, acting commissioner Long said, you know, no police officer witnessed the assault firsthand. They have plenty of evidence that they're combing through, and they have technologies that they think they can use to identify some of the people under those face coverings.
Great. Thanks. Well, I'm coming back to former U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling. We've cleaned up your line a little bit. Welcome back.
Thank you. Let's try it again.
I think my next question to you is about identifying people, right? You've got a group of people marching. They are masked. I think it's a two-part question. One, is there anything legally problematic about the masking in the context of the march, the intent of the march, et cetera? And two, is this something local law enforcement does on its own, or do we expect participation from the federal government on identification? Is there anything that's troubling about that possibility? How do we think about that gnarly problem?
I think on the masking, I think you're just stuck with the masking. I don't think you could legally prevent people, especially when it comes to a political form of protest, from doing that masked. There may be ways to identify those who allegedly assaulted that individual when they marched. And I think what that goes to is I think you definitely want the federal government's involvement for two reasons. One, there's a federal interest in this case. There are federal hate crime laws. If they're able to prove an assault and with a racial intent, then the feds could do that case. And you have the federal investigative resources. Even if local authorities prosecuted that case, that doesn't prevent the FBI from lending a hand and lending its sophistication and resources to the effort.
Okay, and I know Walter here has a follow-up question for you. Go ahead, Walt.
Yeah, U.S. Attorney Lelling, I'm curious about your thoughts on preemptive surveillance. Your predecessor, your successor, U.S. Attorney Rachel Rollins, she brought up the, you know, rhetorical question yesterday, you know, saying that she had asked law enforcement, look, if this was a Black Lives Matter march, would they have received a different level of scrutiny in advance? You know, there are several documented cases of Black Lives Matter activists and groups being, you know, surveilled by the FBI. It's well documented by the Brennan Center for Justice. How do you see the difference then in, you know, them saying that their hands are a little bit tied when it comes to a group like Patriot Front?
Well, I think you want to be very careful with the idea of preemptive surveillance. First, I think there's zero distinction between what federal authorities do when it comes to keeping an eye on groups like Black Lives Matter or keeping an eye on sort of white nationalist groups. I can tell you that the Justice Department for years now has been tracking the rise of right-wing nationalism and, you know, those kind of militant movements in the United States. And so I think they're doing what they're supposed to in that area. But this idea of preemptive surveillance, this question of why didn't we know, I think people need to stop for a moment and think about what it is they're asking. Put aside the alleged assault. If there was an assault, that should be prosecuted, and it should be prosecuted aggressively to make a statement. But as to people congregating and then marching through Boston, people need to think hard about how much federal surveillance they want of people who choose to protest because of a political cause, because next time it might not be the groups that you prefer. And so I'm not sure I would try to saddle the FBI with that kind of responsibility. And that's what Joe Bonavento was trying to say yesterday, right? Depending on whose ox is being gored, people complain that the FBI is keeping track of people, or they complain that the FBI is not keeping track of people. And so I think that can set a little bit of a dangerous precedent.
All right. That is former U.S. Attorney for Massachusetts, Andrew Lelling, with some legal analysis for us there. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us.
Sure. Thanks for having me.
We have been talking this hour about the unannounced march on Saturday by members of Patriot Front, a white supremacist group, on Boston's Freedom Trail Saturday. Again, here's a bit of what that sounded like.
Nazis out of Boston! 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 Nazis out of Boston!
WBUR's Walter Wuthman has been reporting on the story, still with us, has been with us since the beginning of the show, and now here with Walt and me in Studio 2, two additional guests. Reverend Kevin Peterson is the founder of the New Democracy Coalition, and we also have Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo, who is also currently running for Suffolk County DA. Councilor Arroyo, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
And Reverend Peterson, thanks for joining us.
Glad to be here.
So, Reverend, where were you when you found out what was happening on Saturday, and what did you do?
I was across town and was told by activist friends that this was going on. I happened to know or previously have known Mr. Morrell, as he has done some protesting with me around changing the name of Faneuil Hall. So I knew him, and when his name came up, I was immediately alarmed. I know that he is a man who's sort of committed to peace and reconciliation, using the arts to do that. So I was shocked and generally appalled by the fact that my friend was being attacked, but more broadly and more generally, shocked and surprised that there was not appropriate surveillance and not appropriate protection by law enforcement in terms of protecting a person like Mr. Morrell.
Now, I know you heard former U.S. Attorney Andrew Lelling before the break, who said, be careful what you ask for with surveillance because it can cut both ways. You're saying you felt there should have been more surveillance.
Absolutely.
It can cut both ways.
It can cut both
ways. So talk about that.
Well, this is a group that is known internationally as a terrorist organization. The United States hasn't defined them in that way, but we know who they are. They are people who foment, who foster hate, who are about racial violence. So I think that they should have been on the radar. They should have been surveilled. It would have been important for there to be a larger coterie of police officers monitoring their brazen march through the city. I, as a citizen of this city, am particularly embarrassed to talk to other people across the nation around how the city has been caught flat-footed. It's embarrassing.
So, Boston City Councilor Arroyo, do you agree that the city has been caught flat-footed? And do you think the city had both a legal right and an obligation to be surveilling Patriot Front prior to this march?
So, yes and yes. And one of the things that I would note is even in the FBI, who spoke on this yesterday, their statement was that surveillance, in order to do surveillance, there would have had to be a threat, some sort of threat. The Patriot Front had just been arrested 3 weeks ago on the way to disrupt and cause a riot at an LGBT pride event in Idaho. One of the members of this march is a founding member of the Patriot Front, was arrested in Idaho. And so my question, that is a standing question, is if we know for sure and for certain that they were on their way as an organization to disrupt and cause a riot at an LGBT pride event just last month, and they're organizing a meeting in Boston, why isn't there surveillance of the Patriot Front?
So I want to stay with you on that for just a minute. And again, in the back of my mind, I'm mindful that you're running for Suffolk County DA. There's legal implications, right, to the things that you're saying. Mm-hmm. Is there a distinction between being prepared to cause a riot and walking? And I understand the inflammatory way I'm framing this, right? But walking down the street in a group of people, granted with masks on, but walking.
So what I would just say is this was an assault of an individual that occurred. And part of the issue is that's with the benefit of hindsight, that we could say that this was an alleged march through the city of Boston. But at the time, we had zero intelligence, apparently or allegedly, that they were even coming. And so in order to sort of make a distinction between an organization that just planned to disrupt and cause a riot in an LGBT pride event and just shows up in Boston with national leadership that drives in or flies in or however they got here, and we have no intel that they're even coming to the city. There was no notice of what they were going to do. I think at the benefit of it in hindsight is that we can say it was a march and a rally with an assault. But you can't say that we had any intelligence prior to that they weren't
that
coming
they weren't
to do worse.
So the point being, if a group that is known to have a presence in Massachusetts planned a violent act somewhere else and was caught, then automatically there ought to be an increased tracking of their chatter.
Yes, and just to be clear, there was graffiti posted. You know, I saw this on Twitter because I'm a city councilor as well, where somebody flagged it. There was graffiti in early March of Patriot Front propaganda in Dorchester.
Right.
We had NSC 131 at the St. Patrick's Day parade. Then they had that back and forth with the Dropkick Murphys. And so essentially these actions have been growing and happening And the NSC 131, for people listening, is a nationalist white hate supremacist organization who was founded here in Massachusetts.
And just the Dropkick Murphys thing, using their music without permission.
Yeah, and then Dropkick Murphys said, don't do that. And then they said, we'll meet you at South Boston. And right. then they never showed up for that. But right. the reality is there's this growing presence of white nationalist supremacists thinking about Boston as a part of their ideology and the way in which they preach about white supremacy.
Okay, now I want to come back to you, Reverend Peterson, but before I do, a quick clarifying question to Walter Wuthman from WBUR, who's been reporting on this. We have learned some more in the last 24 to 48 hours about the number of people who participated in terms of how many were local versus did this represent sort of a flash march, I think you called it, with people coming in from other states. So just clarify that a little bit for us.
So it seems, the head of the Anti-Defamation League here was speaking about it this morning. It seems that this was much of the group's membership nationally who actually came to Boston Saturday. So these 100 people, they're probably from many states. They're not all local, although some of them most definitely are.
Okay. Now, Reverend Peterson, I want to come back over to you. Today's Wednesday. Monday. Monday, when you, Charles Morrell, and other activists gathered back at the site of the alleged assault, you called for the city to do more. You wanted more anti-racist policies. You wanted a commission to investigate racist, events, attacks in the city. What specifically are you asking for?
Well, I want to start with what Mr. Morrell is asking for today. There will be a meeting between Mr. Morrell and Mayor Wu at 3:30. Following that, there will be a press conference. But Mr. Morrell is, at this point, simply asking for a police report that he's been refused. The civil rights investigation that's been initiated, we believe that report has been completed. He's been refused that. He's asking for a surveillance camera video from the Starbucks that the police have but will not release, give him access to. He's asking for any body camera information. He's asking for the names or the identities of the two police officers whom he said he spoke to on the scene asking for help. Their response, they were not responsive as far as Mr. Morrell is concerned. That is entirely problematic. So those things are on the table first. In a larger sense, because this incident happened within the context of a legacy of racism within Boston, we're calling for a race commission. Mayor Wu, create a race commission so that we can assess the history and legacy of racism in the city, and then began to address it with community conversations, community education, and then perhaps some policies that look towards repair, specifically reparations, or that look towards reconciliation, just in terms of healing the historic climate that's been in place. So there's much to be done in terms of taking advantage of this opportunity as something that's a teachable moment, a learning moment, however tragic it is. Mr. Morrell contends that this is an opportunity to address racism and its systemic grip on the city of Boston.
Okay, Reverend Kevin Peterson of the New Democracy Coalition. Mm-hmm. Just quickly to clarify, first, we were in contact with Charles Morrell yesterday,
yes.
had a conversation with him, invited them to appear on the show today. They deferred.
Mm-hmm.
I cannot confirm or refute what you were just saying, Reverend Peterson, mm-hmm. about the city's stonewalling, my word, not yours, of a number of requests from Charles Morrell. So I will turn.
I spoke with him this morning. I've had direct conversation with him. He's asked me to be a spokesperson. I'm an advisor. So I speak with confidence that this is his position.
This came requested, straight from Charles Morrell.
This came from his mouth, and he's requested these things and has been stonewalled to a certain extent.
So, Boston City Councilor Arroyo, what are the city's obligations today and in this moment to Morrell, to our broader community? What do you want to see the city do now?
I think you should receive all of those things. And I would just say, you know, for me, this is two separate issues. There's an intelligence issue.
That's right.
Which is whether or not BPD had intelligence, and if they did, why didn't they act accordingly to it? If they didn't, as they say, why didn't they? And then there's a second one, which is once they received a 911 call that said there's about 100 white supremacists marching through the city of Boston in paramilitary gear, their response to that, to me, was insufficient. And what I mean by that is, in the case of Mr. Morrell's assault, what we were told in that meeting yesterday was that he was unable to identify his attacker because they all wore masks. The issue I had with that is that there's a very clear photo on the Boston Herald from an official Boston Herald photographer about 3 feet away from this assault. Why is the Boston Herald photographer closer to this column marching through the city than the Boston Police Department? Why was the Boston Police Department, and at this point we're talking about, they started at the Old State House, they're at, essentially had walked past the Copley Library, they're up by the Starbucks, up by the Copley Library. Why in that time frame, which was about 15, 20 minutes, had BPD, the Boston Police Department, not had a sort of cordoned off this section and followed this column to ensure the protection of people in the street, to ensure the protection of folks in the city of Boston as this is happening? I have a lot of questions about that response. And so that response to me was insufficient. And I think the fact that we're sitting here today talking about whether or not we can piece together the identifications of these members en masse on video while they've already traveled out of the state, presumably, when we could have just identified them there in that moment had we had an appropriate Boston Police Department response.
So I think to my question to both of you is, I get the impression that you would agree with community critics who have said that had this been masked people of color carrying Black Lives Matter banners, there would have been a different pre-response and a different response in the moment. Is that, am I incorrect in perceiving
historically,
that?
Historically, there was a policy on the national level called COINTELPRO.
What does that mean?
It was a policy where the federal government surveilled and preemptively identified black, what they would consider black terrorists during the 60s and the 70s, and took certain actions. So the fact that there cannot be or there should not be any kind of policy that looks at a certain type of behavior by people whom the federal government seems to be a threat is ludicrous. And then the larger question is, does the city of Boston have a policy per se, the police department, around identifying and responding to what happened on Saturday? Is there a protocol in place? There seems that there isn't.
Thank you. And Boston City Councilor Roy.
So I've participated in marches after the death of Eric Garner, the murder of Eric Garner, after George Floyd, where I can tell you that the Boston Police Department was very much on scene. In fact, we had state police also on scene. There was situations where you had bike units in essentially the march. And I think part of the issue that I have had with this is that I see this as two separate issues. There's an intelligence issue. We can deal with that later. But there's a response when you get a phone call that there are 100 plus or so white supremacist nationalists marching through the city of Boston on July 3rd with drums taking over sidewalks. My concern, and I've raised this at this meeting that we had, is that Boston Police Department should have been flanking that convoy, should have been in front of that convoy, and should have been behind that convoy. That's right. The fact that I today am on a radio station and we're talking about whether or not we can identify these assailants when they were then essentially met by Boston Police Department at the Back Bay Station where they had a little rally in front of the Tasty Burger, get on a train, go to Oak Grove. Why aren't people being held for questioning? Why aren't we doing these things? At that point, BPD had informed us that they were aware an assault had happened. They were already spoken to Mr. Morrell, or I don't know what his actual, is it Mr. Morrell? Mr. Morrell. And at that point, made no attempt to stop them for questioning, to take numbers, to take addresses, to take names. I understand protected free speech. I am a strong proponent for protected free speech. I participated in these marches in the past for Eric Garner, for George Floyd, for Roe v. Wade, the Women's March, which also had police present. And so when we talk about that, I understand that. Once there's an assault, once you have knowledge that this group has assaulted someone with steel shields in the middle of the city of Boston in broad daylight, that changes. It's no longer a march. It's not a march. I don't know what we want to call that at that point, but it's essentially a walking group of witnesses and people who've assaulted an individual.
And it wasn't a casual assault either. Mr. Morrell had a saxophone strapped around him. That saxophone was pulled off. He had to take it off. He went down to the ground twice, is what he says.
He received stitches.
And received stitches. So it was an extended engagement with these folks, not that moment that's captured by the photographer that we've seen in the newspapers, but something substantive happened there. And when he got off the ground, he looked up at two police officers. He asked for help. They said it's 100 of them versus 4 of us. We can't help you. We'll call the EMS. That's inappropriate. That's for a civilian and a black person. That's inappropriate.
And a resident of Boston.
And a resident. That's just inappropriate. And inappropriate response to the crisis that man was going through.
All right, and I would say in that room, because you asked a question, in that room, I was present for the briefing.
Mm-hmm.
The overwhelming sentiment was that this was different for this organization. I will say that BPD, mm-hmm. in response to what I said, their response was they did not want to look like they were escorting a group of white supremacists through the city. My issue with that is when you are putting optics above and beyond safety of residents of the city of Boston, I have a concern with that decision making. And so that's why I called for a public hearing on this.
Okay, so just a couple of things as we wrap. We should follow with noting that the Patriot Front denies the assault took place. The legal process is still ongoing, just to let you know. I'm going to wrap us there. Boston City Councilor Ricardo Arroyo, who is currently running for Suffolk County District Attorney, and Reverend Kevin Peterson, founder of the New Democracy Coalition. I appreciate you both being here very much. Thank you. So turning back to WBUR's Walter Withman now for just a quick wrap up. Walt, new things that you learned from the conversation just now.
Well, I think Reverend Peterson and Councilor Arroyo bring up incredibly fair questions that I'm eager to see answered in a public setting. And I think there's a larger question for us in the media as well. You know, Patriot Front, by all accounts, really views Saturday as a success. You know, they're bragging about it on their Telegram channels. They're posting these pictures. They think it all went great. And so I'm always thinking about, and I think we should continue to discuss how we cover these things, you know, how law enforcement prosecutes these things, and these questions of surveillance will definitely persist as well.
All right. That's WBUR's Walter Withman, who is reporting on and will continue to report on the Patriot Front March.
Hey, Nini, hey, Nini, Kataligi.
Doesn't that sound nice? That is Tommy Sands' Irish lullaby, A Nee Nee. Does it make you want to sleep? Can you sleep? Between disturbing daily news, economic anxiety, inflation, an ongoing pandemic, life? There is a lot to keep us up at night. According to the National Institutes of Health, Heart, Lung, and Blood, between 50 and 70 million Americans have sleep disorders, and 1 in 3 adults do not get the recommended amount of uninterrupted sleep. I think I probably don't. Today on Be Well, where we focus on our wellness, sleep. How to get more of it, how to get better at it, what to do when you can't. Dr. Robert Thomas joins us here in Studio 2. Dr. Thomas is an associate professor in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a specialist in sleep medicine and pulmonary disease at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Dr. Thomas, thank you.
Welcome.
Great to have you. So we're told as we grow up, 8 hours, right? Every once in a while I hear 7, but really I hear 8 hours. It's a magic number. Is that true?
Not really. 7 hours is the official statement by the American Academy of Sleep Medicine for the average adult. But there is no exact number. Some need less, some need a little bit more. And of course, there's a very large difference across life. When you're newborn, you sleep about 18 hours. Teenagers need clearly more than 7 hours. You know, if you're age 90 and you're targeting 7 hours, it could be a little bit difficult. But 7 is a working number. It's a bit like a body mass index. You know, less than 25 is, you know, a good number. But if you're a person working out in the gym and putting on a lot of muscle, you know, your body mass index can be higher than 25 and you may be actually very healthy.
So how does one know one's own sleep needs? How do I figure out for me, as me, what my number is?
Yeah, so across a lifetime, it is usually evident to any average person in what I would call neutral conditions, how much they would sleep.
So just how much your body just does it. So if you could go to bed when you were tired, wake up when you wake up, you would normalize around a number that's the right number for your body?
Pretty much, you know, you have to clear out any excessive sleep debt. So if you've done a lot of shift work and now you're catching up, that's a little different. But you ask almost anybody how long they think they can sleep, what's their natural sleep, they'll be fairly accurate. it'll be unusual for someone to say, I have no idea how much sleep I need, you know, individually.
So we hear a lot about this concept called sleep hygiene. So tell me, what is sleep hygiene and what are the basic practices?
It's a terrible term because it sounds like it's not a serious thing. But sleep hygiene is a set of behaviors which, if you deviate from, you put your sleep system at stress. So, you know, having a steady wake-up time, being in darkness when you're sleeping, and 2 or 3 hours prior to that, you want to avoid bright light.
Before you go to bed, you should not be in a brightly lit room for a couple of hours?
Bad idea. All of us need a biological evening. That's when our melatonin levels, in fact, rise. So as a working rule, I tell my patients, you know, after 8 o'clock, turn the lights down. Give your eyes a little bit of dark adaptation. You can kind of get by.
So we had a – actually, because you brought up this melatonin, I'm gonna pause you for a second. We reached out to our texting group, and if you'd like to join listeners, you can join our texting group by texting the word Boston to 617-766-0382. That's Boston to 617-766-0382. And Joyce from East Falmouth said, I was awake until 4 a.m. the other night, up by 7. Last night I took a melatonin. Believe it or not, I think my sleep is affected by the cycles of the moon. I read before I go to bed, so no screen. I'm still tired when I get up, though. End quote. So, what is she doing wrong in this sleep hygiene? And can cycles of like light and dark, and when the sun comes up and goes down, when the moon is up, affect how we sleep?
Oh, definitely. You know, the kind of winter and summer difference in light which we have in the northeast, northwest, clearly can affect sleep. All of us tend to wake up slightly earlier in summer and sleep a little bit later in winter if, you know, we don't use alarms as an example. If a person wakes up, you know, substantially earlier than desirable consistently, either they are, you know, extreme morning larks, which is a, you know, kind of natural extreme of the population.
But that's a nice way to talk about it, a morning lark.
Yeah. Or they have potentially a sleep disorder or a disorder like anxiety, which is causing awakenings early. It'd be uncommon for a person to just suddenly start waking up very early without a good reason. Either they've always been a morning type or something is afoot, and melatonin usually will not solve that. In fact, if you take melatonin at bedtime to try to wake up later, it doesn't work. It actually makes you wake up earlier. Melatonin is just darkness. So if you get extra darkness before you go to bed, you'll actually wake up earlier. So a person getting up too early, taking melatonin at bedtime, is the exact opposite of what he or she should be doing.
So I'm going to play two pieces of sound for you, and I'll do sort of the first half of each of these. So here is snoring. Okay, but now here is what's called sleep apnea. Now, we have, I feel like I'm suffocating just listening to that. You know, we have a public running understanding that at a certain age, people will begin to maybe snore. Is that a problem, other than if you're sleeping next to someone who's snoring, in terms of getting enough sleep? And what is the difference between that first thing we heard, which is snoring, and that second thing we heard, which is called sleep apnea?
Yeah. So everybody has a somewhat narrower airway while sleeping because the muscles do relax. And vibrations generated from that narrowing is probably universal. When they reach a certain frequency and a certain intensity, it becomes audible snoring. And snoring just means that your airway is narrow. It's like a bit of a trumpet kind of effect. And it's incredibly common. It's especially common in areas of the world where people are smaller. Like Asia, as an example, you know, snoring is so common that, you know, we just kind of live with it. Now, snoring also obviously reflects a narrow airway. And if the narrowing is enough that now there are biological consequences, like a drop in oxygen or the need to keep waking up and such, then snoring also gets more fractionated, like what you heard in that recording.
With that sleep apnea recording.
And that starts becoming, you know, into the area which we call sleep apnea, of which there is a tremendous range in severity and patterns and so on.
And that's basically a cutting off of the breath that can disrupt sleep, yes?
Sleep apnea will disrupt sleep, basically.
All right. So I want to play another sound for you here. Listeners, this is jarring. Alarm clock. Will it affect your sleep and the quality of your sleep if that's how you wake up in the morning? Or is it okay to wake up to blah, blah, blah in the mornings?
You know, typically when we wake up in the morning, we don't have a choice that, you know, we have to wake up at a certain time. Right? And if you have an abrupt awakening, it's usually unpleasant. And actually, if you have an abrupt awakening, your heart rate goes up, your blood pressure goes up. Not sure I would call it dangerous, but it's probably not a desirable thing. I mean, you can't come in late for work saying that I was waiting for my natural sleep cycle to be over. You're going to get fired if you do that. So it is best that, you know, one has a steady wake-up time and give adequate time for sleep. So the likelihood that you're in deep sleep early in the morning is minor. And waking from REM sleep is usually cleaner in the sense that you wake up a little sharper. You're not, groggy and half drunk. Otherwise, if you wake up from deep sleep, you have what's called sleep inertia, where there is essentially you're in a brain fog. You're not fully awake. Cognition is, you know, not great at that time. Your attention is poor. But it usually dissipates over the next, you know, 5, 10, 15 minutes. You know, when you're brushing your teeth, you're kind of waking up, basically. But if you wake up from deep sleep and you're answering the phone, you know, you may say something stupid or not remember what you actually said.
Because you're not really fully awake.
You're not fully awake. Not really fully awake.
All right. So we've got about room for one sentence. Single best sleep practice.
Steady, regular wake-up time is probably the single best thing. That goes without saying that you do need to give adequate sleep time. So you can't go to bed at 2 and get up at 6 every morning.
Dr. Thomas said.
Exactly.
All right. Dr. Robert Thomas is an associate professor in the Division of Sleep Medicine at Harvard Medical School and a specialist in sleep medicine and pulmonary disease at Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Thanks, Dr. Thomas.
Thank you.
And that is our show for today. Radio Boston is produced by Chris Siderick, Amanda Beeland, and Sydney Bowles with Maya Schwader. Marquise Neal is our technical director. Titus Faladun is our executive producer. I'm Tiziana Deering. Thanks for listening. Join us again tomorrow for more Radio Boston.